Welcome to the Dad's Night Podcast, where ridiculous becomes reality. We're your dad hosts. I'm Chris Parrish.
And I'm Tommy Reed.
And I'm Ray Stevenson.
There we go.
Today we're joined by classically trained movie and theater actor Ray Stevenson, star of The Punisher, Rome, Kill the Irishman, Thor, and numerous roles ranging from Blackbeard to Volstagg. We'll also talk about his experience as a dad of three boys and raising them during these crazy times. Here we are, Tommy.
Man, that music, it just never gets old.
Every single week, never you love it. Old. I love to watch you dance.
How it just fires me up. It's like running out of the tunnel for game day. I'm pumped
It's
up.
Exactly like that, yeah.
Really, really special. We're going to go right into our three dubs, and that's called Where You Going, What You Doing, and What You Excited About. Chris,
yes.
I know you came back very excited, a little tired.
Yep, I was up. We've got 6 to 8 guys did our annual camping trip this weekend, so we haven't done it in a few years because you couldn't camp outside. But we went back up there, up in Big Bear. It's a good time. My daughter Lainey's godfather, Cody, flew in from Texas.
No Deliverance-style stories?
No. It is, it's 6 old guys at this point.
Well, you never know.
We leave it at 2 days.
Okay.
So we can get back without any of that happening. But we did, we drive up near Big Bear. It's called Barton Flats. We've been going up there about 20 years. I do a bunch of cooking. We basically play wiffle ball.
There
for
it
two
is.
Straight days. I'm very sore. I'm tired. There was a coyote sighting on the campsite Saturday night, which was exciting. So
no hallucinogenics were involved in this one.
No. This was a straight. No, not yet. Okay. This was a legit coyote.
Wow. Does he growl at you, or did you just see him and then he runs away?
Just kind of hanging out, minding your own business, missing your wives, thinking about your kids. You know, we're sitting by the campfire, it's about 9 o'clock, and there's campsite next to us, there's these dogs, they start losing their shit, right? And I'm like, what's going on, right? And then you hear the coyote, right? And so Cody, by the way, my buddy, who's my daughter's
friend of the pod,
who at some level in society is needs to protect my daughter if it comes down to that.
He's just the best. I met him.
Sprints to the car, trying to find an open car to hide inside the car because there's this coyote. And by the way, coyotes are like 2 feet tall, howling. He's like, our buddy Jeremy's up there. Jeremy, open the car. Open the car. Jeremy, open the car. And I'm like, Cody, settle down, man. It's a coyote or whatever. So we start flashing the flashlight out there. And you can see this thing. It's about 30 feet away. Now, when I tell this story in a few years, it'll be 10 feet away. Right now, it's about 30 feet away. You can see his eyes. He's this little thing, and he runs off. He's gone. That was it. He saw us, took off. Looking right at us, though.
Man.
Looking tasty. And then the guys next to us who we had met, who are actually our friends of the pod, they were listening, Eddie and Jose from Redlands.
Nice, friends of the pod.
We just met that day. So they saw Cody run to the car. It's one of the most hilarious things you've ever seen. And so they found a YouTube recording of a coyote making noise, and they started playing it through this speaker, and then they slowly started walking it over to our campsite. And Cody was gone, man. There was like a smoke outline of a 5'9" dude.
Well, that's what you do. You go camping and you haze your buddies.
Yeah.
He's still
jittery.
Chops.
You brought him over to your house yesterday. You could tell he was still on edge.
Yeah, well.
But it was good. And then we came
great
back.
Guy.
We had to leave at 6 in the morning yesterday to coach soccer. So the story of a dad.
Nice.
Dad weekend. Yeah, how was your weekend?
Well, you know, it was awesome. It ended a little slow Sunday morning because I had my buddy over for some cocktails.
Pre-production.
We did a little Grandview pickleball tournament.
I heard about this.
And after that.
And this is your first time playing pickleball?
Yes, it was.
So how did you feel, just before you get into your story, how did you feel about this sport that's taking the nation and especially the South Bay by storm? This is your first time playing.
You know, I feel like everyone should play with a cocktail in their hand,
yeah.
Period. If you're not doing that like that, then you're not really playing pickleball.
Not really playing, agreed.
Okay, so I immediately did a shot before we even started the game.
Yeah.
So my wife and I did shot. We were fired up.
Well, you were teammates.
You were teammates, okay. Yeah. We wore our Wimbledon white.
Love that.
And then all of a sudden we... you know, got into the game. I was just hooting and hollering, mm-hmm. And we lost. And then,
and you're typically a stoic player in the court because you and I played doubles.
But, see, it's one of those things where we didn't know it was the first 15. We thought you had to win by 2. So we were at 15-14, and then we kept on playing, and we lost 20-18.
That's a long
game.
But
we let the, yeah, we exactly. We let that other team advance, mm-hmm. Just because we're good people.
You are.
Okay.
You're a giver.
But then in the consolation loser bracket, we run 15-3. But that was it. And then I'm like, we got to go get my buddy Ray. Let's go have some cocktails with him. Went over back to the bar 533. Probably around 8 o'clock, around that.
Starting early. I like that.
You know, and then midnight. And then, by the way, like my son, this is a great quick dad segment. My son came down with a stomach, like pain and everything. And immediately we're like, what do we do? What kind of medicine should we give him? Ray took out the old healing hands.
Ray Stevenson, the
Ray
actor.
Ray Stevenson, okay. The actor, came over and gave Grayson like a tummy rug for like, what, 15 minutes? You were rubbing
just talking to him.
Yeah, just talking to him, yeah. Rubbing his stomach. It was great. And he was fine.
Where'd you learn this?
Well, no, I've got three boys. I mean, basically, you know, there are certain things you learn very quickly to go through.
Yeah.
Because kids can't express, and they don't have the vocabulary to describe quite it is. So there's a couple of straightforward things, little pressure, little sort of circular movement on the stomach, and find out if it's trapped gas. You know, you make a joke about any Coca-Cola, the bicarbonate soda will loosen up, they break down the big bubble into little ones, and you'll fart your way to happiness. But also just in case there is something.
My son's already doing it.
But also just in case there is something that, and you find one particular spot where it's like, you know, a little bell in your head, and you go, okay, but you're keeping a kid calm.
Yeah.
And you're keeping a contact to them, and they're involved. And there was something, maybe it was just a tummy knot, and I asked him, did you play any sports today? Did you take a bash? Because sometimes at night, you know, when everything's calm, that's when the pain comes out. I heard that throughout my rugby playing days. I felt like a warrior, like a god, and I got home, and it was just like, that all comes out. So with kids as well, sometimes it's literally just to calm them down so they're not tensing up. But also that little thing, because of course, you know, you just want to find out, is there anything?
Right.
And you are not alarmist at all. You're like, oh my God, we're running to the doctor. When you're doing it, and it's stressing the kid out. So, just calmed him down. Apparently, he went upstairs and that was it.
That was it. It was just level of respect, not only for him just being a friend of mine and one of the most talented actors I've ever worked with, but just being that dad right there in the moment to even like calm me down and calm the situation with him. It was like so.
And also, yeah. I have to add, right? I mean, testimony to the parents here, to have a child who, how old is he?
He's nine.
He's nine. To have a child at nine and that has never met me before.
Right.
And knows his friend of his dad and mom's, but has never met me before and yet has a level of trust to be able to lie down, right? Just like let his belly then let somebody, right? In the comfort of his home. But also that's a trust thing.
Yeah.
And also it's an openness and an open heart to allow that to happen. And that was the privilege. That's the gift he gave me.
Awesome. I mean,
wow.
So that was, so that's part of my three dubs. And then we go into then Sunday and we had just a killer game. Van Hass just scripted out some great plays. And
just
we won
another
19
week for
nothing.
Him. You know, he calls it Sunday. Just another week for him.
That's it. I mean, we won 19-0. We gave up one first down, but they didn't get me on a trick play. They did opening, which we were on defense first, and they did the center comes up there and picks up the ball and starts walking over to the sideline. I have the wrong ball. And so we're all like confused. And then halfway through, as he's walking to the sideline, he then darts down the sideline going to the end zone. I'm like, Harrison, go get him, run. And then they ran backwards. And, of course, Harrison's the fastest kid in the whole
Harrison
league.
Harrison Cornell.
Yes. Yeah. And he gets him, pulls his flag. But Van's yelling, it's a live ball. And we didn't know. And they got us good. They got me good.
Well, you know, it's a Pyrrhic victory.
Yeah.
You know,
but they didn't score. They didn't score. And
they
then I stopped
that,
him right
it's
there.
It's kitchen sink game playing, you guys. You got to throw everything you can at him.
I said, kids, let's raise the roof. Yeah. Let's bring the house. Yeah. We blitzed them constantly. I think Jack Kotzman had four sacks. I think Harrison Cornell had like a punt return touchdown, interception touchdown.
Not surprising.
Two running touchdowns. Mm-hmm. And like it was just, and like three interceptions. It was crazy. But like we brought the house defense. So feeling really good. We got one more game left in the season. Then the playoffs start. And there we go.
Then you throw out the record books.
Everybody's
0-0 when the playoffs start.
Yep. And so hopefully.
Two teams out there.
I can get us to SoFi and I could have you come to SoFi Stadium to watch a championship, Ray. That'd
Your
be
dream,
great to have you there.
To watch 9-year-olds play American football.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Finally.
It's great. So I'm just super excited because as we just prefaced, we have one of my favorite actors who means the world to me personally because he made my dream come true. And I know he's been in numerous other movies that give him great acclaim and everything. But for me, he will always be Danny Green to me. And I know the city of Cleveland relishes and loves this man as much as I do. Ladies and gentlemen, Ray Stevenson is in the house.
Welcome.
Yes.
Welcome. It's
Ray.
An honor.
Bless you. Thank you for having me.
It is so great to have you here. And, you know, I'm just going to tell you a quick story because it took me 13 years to make Kill the Irishman. And it was always going to be this combination of, well, we can't go have this, like, a guy that's going to be so well-known that they're going to recognize that guy for being Danny Green. And you had, you just came off, I think it was Rome, the series, and The Punisher. And The Punisher. And here we go, and they bring in Ray Stevenson as the first attachment. We're like, oh my God, this is amazing. He's going to look like Danny Green. They did all these great things. And then all of a sudden they bring in then Christopher Walken, Val Kilmer, and Vincent D'Onofrio as the supporting cast. And then the movie got greenlit. And I remember going on set and seeing him for the first time. And I was like, it really stopped because like when you see what you've worked your whole life for and you get to on set and now you're in Detroit, where we were filming.
Motown, baby.
And
Wild West.
Yeah. I mean, crazy stories that go on Detroit. But when you go in and you see now, I think the first day I arrived, it was at the old Detroit Tigers stadium that they were tearing down.
Right.
And we literally filmed in a portion of it that was not
Did
yet.
Did you really?
Yes, torn down. And you can see in the movie, there's a scene where Ray's walking into the ballpark with Vinnie Jones and he's got his whole team with him. And I remember seeing him like, holy shit, he looks just like Danny Green. This is unbelievable. Unbelievable. And he's got the wardrobe on and I'm like, oh man, Ray's a big dude.
Yeah.
And Ray, what are you, 6'4"?
6'2 or 6'3 and a half in my socks, something like that.
And
fellow big man,
a big dude.
Danny Green, although you know, I think he was a little shorter than I am, but his personality was a big personality.
Yes, he was.
You know, you knew when he just rocked up. He didn't have to do anything.
Yeah,
you were horrifying in that movie. Like I love sort of like
well, there's
mob
a certain
type
way of looking
movies.
At the psychology of people who violence is their life, and you've got to find the truth of it. Because I think what actors do when and all we do and all that we do is hold the mirror up to human condition.
Yeah,
and I was talking to Tommy about this scene the other night when there's the biker's creating a big problem across the street, and Danny goes in ostensibly to save the day. He's not going to shoot him. But he is going to give him a beating. And I remember talking to Jonathan Hensley, the director of the time. I says, you know what? There's something about the psychology of this man. And he didn't know, but his wife and kids are up on the opposite side. So at the end of the fight, he's beat this guy, but he's got him over the hood of this car. And I just stopped pounding on him. But
yeah,
I said, I want to do it rhythmically. Not where there's no sort of
left
seeing
right combo.
Red aggression. There's a different level of aggression, which is more terrifying. And when he's finished, he finishes in his own time. And it's just bam, bam, bam. But to the point where even hardened, violent men just go, hang on, what's going on? And backstory of that is I'd read some research about violent men. And it's basically, they kind of break into two distinct characters. The ones who will see red, and they're berserkers. And they just don't push it. And then when it goes, they're like Tasmanian devils. They go berserk. Very, very dangerous. And then there's the other violent man. Unlike the one who see red and go crazy, whose heart rate goes right up through the roof, the other violent men, their heart rate slows. The more violent they get, now they'll kill you.
Oh, man.
And you just, that psychological trick of like, when he had him, Danny Green's heart rate was slowing.
Right.
And I think the human condition is that, you know, like you feel it. It's not about graphically displaying, but you feel that energy, and then you go like, whoa, you know what I mean? So bringing those unspoken and having the freedom to do that, to build that up, is just like what keeps a violent man who still has control of all his faculties. The guy went vegetarian in his life, and he started looking after his physique, and da-da-da-da-da, and he was an intelligent man. They just right. couldn't kill him, But he had that quality that when he went violent, it wasn't like, oh, he's crazy. No.
Well,
you just don't want to let him.
Yeah. I watched that scene again this weekend. I was just catching up on stuff. And so, I mean, you're just calmly walking across the street and you're like, oh my God, like,
yeah,
that guy's a goner, right? And you're just methodical. and you're starting to see like a bit of the splatter on the screen and all that stuff. Yeah. Juxtaposed against, like, you know, there's that scene in The Godfather where like Sonny just loses it on Carlo on the street, right?
Exactly.
Sonny was nuts.
Sonny goes hot. Sonny goes through the roof with his heart.
Where when you walk into like those guys are partying and that guy, you come back here and I'm going to do, oh my God. Yeah. You're like, he's a, oh my God. It was just horrifying.
Yeah.
It,
and he takes his jewelry, like a very he takes kind his jewelry man, off.
So, yeah.
You know, I thought, it's a decent play. And I like the bit when he turned, when Danny's ready and done, he just calmly just turns around, grabs his stuff, takes a cigarette, lights a cigarette, and you see the behind the back of the shot is his wife and kids, and Danny's not even acknowledged them, right? Because Danny is now going back to his griddle.
Yeah.
His grill. You know what I mean? So, and then she's looking, that look on Linda Cardellini's face is just like, she thinks she knows her husband, had two children with him, and now she witnesses this.
Yeah.
She goes like, I had no idea. You know what I mean? So these are powerful sort of visual moments which make movies.
Right.
You know? And it's not having the wise crack or the quick line. And that can be too telling because, you know, human condition is like actions speak louder than words.
Well, there's no coincidence why it became, during COVID, had this huge resurgence on Netflix and literally became the most popular. I think it hit number 7 on the charts globally in 2020.
Nice.
And I think it was like August of 2020, and Netflix, we're all like freaking 10. Out. I'm like, what? Yeah. When did this happen?
It has that. It's now in there in the lexicon of gangster movies. And also, I think what I kind of appreciate about it now is the 3 decades: the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The 70s was building up to when Americana was at its largest.
Right.
Cars, suits, characters, personalities, right? Industrial nationals. After the 70s, phones, everything got smaller.
Yep.
Everything went underground. No longer would you see the Don or the Dons walking the street, right? But that was one of the last big plays. And that was when America was industrializing the world and expanding and basically building into the American empire. Sort of
right.
Thing. I sort of think it's a bit of a sort of airbag empire, unfortunately. It kind of came and just... But all empires have to end. But it was fascinating to be part of that. And the car you got me, the green Caddy, right? I asked Jonathan, I says, I'm coming around the corner. I'm not like running away. But I said, how do you want me to drive it? And he went, drive it like you stole it. And you go like, I love this direction.
That's
so,
awesome.
You know, and it's just because I basically am driving it home, get out, go into home, but I'm straight out the back.
Right.
So it's one of those, you know.
Well, you definitely were supported by an ensemble.
Oh, yes.
And there's some characters in there that I know on set there were, when you were working, that some of the other guys that were sitting in Video Village were kind of like, you know, when he walked in to look at Video Village, that's Christopher Walken we're talking about,
right,
who played Shonda Burns. They kind of all stopped talking, and then they were kind of just watching him watch everything. And he was an interesting character. He had black sweatpants that he probably just got from Target. He had a belt that went up to just underneath his chest, basically, and a black T-shirt. And he would go at night, walk the streets of Detroit, which it was not a safe area.
No,
okay?
Even
though we were
incidents.
At the Cadillac Hotel, which was like the nicest hotel.
Everything was boarded up around us.
Everything was boarded up around us. Mm. We actually had a production van stolen with the guy in the car. That they ran around.
And this is like 2009 when you're filming, right?
Yeah, 2000. Yeah. Was it eight?
Eight or nine.
Eight or nine.
Yeah.
And just craziness. But what was it like working with Christopher Walken to him?
You know, this is it's one of those sort of, you know, the beauty of it is that a man of his caliber, or indeed women of that caliber, they go to work. And I remember the first time we met, I shook hands and just say we caught each other's eyes and that. And then we had the opportunity to sit down together, just him and I. And unlike him, I don't make notes on my script, right? But I believe he may be, I don't want to speak out of turn, maybe he has a dyslexia. So I've seen actors like that before. And so they are methodical with their scripts and because they learn it all. Because they don't want to, they can't get up there and words get mixed up. Right. I'm not sure. I mean, I don't want to speak out of turn.
Right.
But the way he noted his script is different colored pens. Probably for different emotional or physical aspects, his whole script was annotated. And I hardly ever annotate the script because I want to get it. I'm not playing the page, but it's just a different process. But it was interesting to see that. And just through the playing of it, and, you know, when you feel an actor like that, he's not telephoning it in, like, I've done it all before, and da-da-da-da-da, and
right.
I was Deer Hunter. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
But he goes to work. And I love that they respect the piece that they're doing. It's not a passport piece to do another job. That's the job they're doing, and they're investing in it and discovering, and they're going to work, and you can go to work with it, and you can do that in the scene as well. So it's long, and you know, you're not, nobody's messing around, and they, you know, it becomes a fellow actor, even though, you know, before the nervousness, and then afterwards the sort of the pleasure you feel after you finish. Oh my God, I actually did work with him. But during the work, you got to work with an actor.
Right.
You know, so it's a privilege. It is, you know, it's happened to me a couple of times. I've been blessed enough. I have this realization. Then also on the other ones, I don't suffer fools. I mean, when you get the other ones coming up, the memes of this world who are all about me, I can't be asked if you haven't done the work.
Right. Right.
It's just like, you know, you haven't worked. You don't know what the scene is. It's just, well, why turn up? I mean, it's like they learn their lines and they learn them like they learn a performance, right? And they listen in their heads of how the other actors are going to speak. I actually had an actor say, I didn't think you were going to say your lines like that. And I said, really? So in your hotel room last night where you're admiring yourself in the mirror, practicing, and basically you've learned your scene.
We want names, Ray.
No, you're not even directing it. And it's just like, you imagine how I was going to do my performance as well. I said, why did you limit yourself so much? You haven't learned the scene. You just learned. You learned the pages.
Right.
That's not what the scene's about. The scene is underneath. It's always about the subtext.
Of course.
And if the words skip along the top. So you, in learning the scene, you can play with it, and you can rise and fall and play it and create. It's almost like a piece of music, or you got the palette to create the picture, and it's motion pictures, not coming up and repeating what you learned in your hotel room.
Yeah.
Now, did you apply that thinking when you also work with Denzel Washington on the Book of Eli?
I mean, there's another. The prime example was already in my head. Denzel and Gary Oldman on Book of Eli, and there was, and I also, whenever Denzel's on set, imagine all eyes are on him.
Oh my gosh,
boring into him.
I can't imagine.
He's just a consummate actor, and no wonder why he is a deserving double Oscar winning. Person, and he did. There was a scene where we are in the desert, and he's been protecting this book, which Gary's after. Gary Oldman's character's after, and he's got this mantra of "Stay on the path, stay on the path, stay on the path." And Oldman shoots him, and this complete and utter disbelief that I can't make sense. He's been driven and somehow protected to have this mission of protect, and I'm shot, and he has to play this moment, and he would, and we're stood there in the desert with the wind going on, and you could see him. I'm not going to use the word fail. I'm going to say you could see him not get it, not right. And many people would have said, like, if you got it on camera, da da da, right, let's move on. Right. No, he worked and worked and worked until there was this lightning in a bottle. He was not shy. He was fearless. And afterwards, I remember I went up to, he was sitting on the steps of his trailer, and I walked up to him, I extended my hand, and he just raised his head. He looked, I just want to say thank you, Denzel. Masterclass, thank you. He went, oh, thanks, Ray. And I realized in that moment, hardly anybody goes and thanks him or expresses or praises, because you think, I'm not going to go and praise Denzel, because obviously he knows. And you realize the sensitivity and the courage it takes to go to that level, exposing it while all eyes are boring on you, and you'll be able to push that out and get it wrong and get it wrong and get it wrong with no guarantee you're going to get it right. But through the work, you get that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, go say thank you.
Wow.
The courage is inspiring.
Oh, that's
you know?
Great.
And you know, Gary Oldman is again, another one. And you'll never get any moaning nonsense. I mean, Gary told a story, but I couldn't repeat it here. I don't know, should I?
If it's bad, I'll edit it out.
All right. Gary told this story about when he was doing Dracula, and he's got 4 hours in the, he's in at 3:30 or 4 in the morning. He's got 3.5 hours of makeup, and he says, and in He says 7 o'clock's coming around 7 o'clock, and in rocks this actress who shall remain nameless, Winona Ryder. And she drops her bag and looks at the clock. Oh my God! Like, what time do we wrap? And he goes, "This is just every day." And he's been there. And he, at one moment, he had enough, and he just stood up. He says, "Winona, dear, come here. What are you getting for this? Two and a half?" And she went, "Maybe more." He says, "Oh yeah, fucking earn it."
Wow.
I love it.
I love that.
Love this guy.
Yeah, yeah.
That's great.
But there's a truth to these guys that they bring it.
Sure.
It's not fake. And it's just like...
Let's
go to work. And they're not judgmental. And they're not sort of holier than thou. It's the middle rankers who aren't in their imagination where they should be. Who try and get the status play and stuff like this. These guys, I've always maintained being classically trained, serve the play and the play will serve you.
Right.
You know? There's a line in Hamlet of the play within the play where Hamlet is saying, the play's the thing in which we catch the conscience of the king. To me, the king is the audience. So the play's the thing in which we'll catch the audience's conscience and serve the play. The play will serve you.
Man, this is unbelievable. This is a masterclass in podcasting.
No. Yeah. I'm a lifer. It's my vocation. It's not a desire to chase money or to chase celebrity. I'm aware that difference between celebrity and fame. I'm aware that you need a modicum of fame to enable projects and to keep working at more diverse and more interesting and continuous work. And so that's not to be poo-pooed and sort of snubbed down. And it's kind of like a... It's a privilege, and you have to respect any fame that comes along with it and have the responsibility to use that fame properly to tell stories.
When did you start acting?
I don't know where it came from. I grew up in the north, in Northern Ireland, then the northeast of England. And we never went to theatre. We were too busy living week to week. It was a very humble background, you know, and I never met actors. We'd do this Saturday morning picture show where they'd drop the kids off. And it was always like actors came from somewhere else, the other side of the world. I mean, it was like, no. But something inside me was always drawn to either movie critic shows or movies. And not to the point of like, I want to be the next John Wayne. Never that. It was so removed from me. But there was something drawing me to it. And I felt later on in my late teens and 20s, I think it was like an alter ego. All I had to do was go to the theater once on my own or go to the cinema and I'd feed the beast and it would calm down. Well, the beast would come back. And something kept drawing. I have no idea why. Until finally, I gave in about 25. I was working as an interior designer in an architectural practice, and in London. And I was seeing the theatres. And then I was drawn. And then I went. I started evening school, a bona fide evening school with real directors and actors who were teaching. And I knew, and it terrified the life out of me. And I knew how real it was.
Oh.
So then I started going twice a week. Because I'd see serious questions, and I knew that it's going to take a commitment. It's going to have to be a leap of faith. But at least I'd had life experience enough not to go foolhardy and to say it has to be enough to be an actor.
Right.
If that just gets you through the week, whether you're doing theatre or whether you're doing a little spot on TV, if it's enough to sustain you as an actor, you're a successful actor if you're working. The other stuff comes along, and then that brings responsibilities not to be a wanker. ultimately. I got into Bristol Old Vic Theatre School at 27, and I left at 29 years old and started. I got my first job 2 weeks before I left, and I've never had to do anything else. But it's been feast, famine, famine, feast, famine, famine, feast, famine, But I've been a jobbing, working actor in a variety of stuff, and it's just, and it's fulfilled me. And then as a family grows, you ask yourself and leaping into this profession, but you realize the responsibility of you're asking your family to accept this thing that takes you away in huge blocks. So you make sure when you're there, you're not a 9-to-5 dad who's away at work during the day. You make sure you're present.
Right.
Right. You know, because it's a commitment from them to understand. Yeah. And you're leading by example and saying, expressing the fact that, you know, dad's going away to do something he loves. I'm going to miss you like crazy, but this is what he loves to do, and it fulfills him. One day you're going to want to leave home and pursue something you love. I'm going to pat you on the back, miss you like damn crazy, and then say, you know, when you're ready, come home, tell us all about it.
Yeah.
That is awesome.
You lead by example.
Because that is such an important thing to the sanity of a man.
And when people talk down to kids, you don't have to talk down. You just don't have to you don't have to use over sophistication, which makes them feel dumb. Like, you don't also have to, like, just talk down to them and talk them in little kiddie voices. They're a lot more smarter. They're a lot more, on an instinctive level, they feel the truth. You know? So, and you can't placate them and all this. Like, when my sons were talking about, especially the 10-year-old, obviously kids at school, about, you know, Christmas, Father Christmas, they're all saying that, you know, it's a fake, it's a lie. And I had this moment, I just thought, you know what? It's not. He exists. I said, what do you mean? I said, Father Christmas is about magic, right? And there is an element to magic in the universe of how synchronicity things fall into place when you're on the right path. Yeah, but they're saying, you know, he's making wooden toys up in that. He said, but what about all the tech toys and all this sort of stuff? I says, how do these companies who make these tech toys get inspired to make the presents that children are going to want at Christmas time? Who do you think inspires them? Who sprinkles the magic in their imagination to create bikes and tablets and games? I says, you know, how do you think he works? He doesn't hammer wood into toy. That's just part of the magic. Of course he exists. When people get inspired to make things for children that's going to make playing and fun and da-da-da, I says, that's Santa Claus.
Yeah.
Don't lose that.
Oh, my gosh. This is awesome.
I'm going to write that down because awesome. I'm in range of that one coming through.
Oh, my gosh.
And again, you know, I defy anybody to stand up and say, no, you're talking absolutely rubbish. I said, where does inspiration? Well, I'm talking like there's no such thing as inspiration and where that comes from.
So you do have three sons. So you,
I do.
And what ages are they?
Well, right now, the eldest one is 14.
14.
The youngest one just turned 11 on the 11th. And the young one, who is 7, is going to be 8 on the 4th of July.
There it is. Nice. My wife's birthday. Yeah. So did the 14-year-old kind of ruin it for the 11 and 7-year-old by saying that? Or was
no.
it friends outside?
It's school. It's,
yeah,
it's you
school.
Know what I mean? Of course it is.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
And it's, but it's this thing. I remember reading, we were advised to read a book at theater school called The Uses of Enchantment by a guy called Bruno Bettelheim, who was a child in the Second World War who was in a concentration camp, witnessed the murder of his whole family. Mm. But he was picked up at 10 years old by American GIs, and he was brought to New York, where he grew to be a child psychologist. And he witnessed, and what he described later on as the pastelization, the Disneyfication of the true fables and fairy tales of Grimms and Aesops. These are instructions for children's growth, right? Not all giants are to be trusted. And to child, like their parents are giants. Can't trust all giants, though. And what after the horrors of the Second World War, he witnessed that people wanted to remove, you know, the nasty side of it, right? The dark side. And this is the pastelization of it. The softening of it, the stripping away of the essence of the story that enabled growth in a young imagination, right? So it was so counterproductive. So he talks about the uses of enchantment. And I think this thing about magic is just like, you know, like we've got a very good friend called Guy Laliberté, who was the founder of Cirque du Soleil. What he brought back to the spectacle of a show is enchantment.
It really is.
And these stories reverberate on different levels. And so... audiences of any age and ethnicity and whatever can go and watch it, and in their spheres can be enchanted. Not going there saying, oh, I'm going to do this kid's show tonight with my kid. I have to sit through it because, you know, it's a kid's thing. And, you know, what do you want, a medal? No, you're going to get something from it.
Ah, because it's so entertaining.
He brought enchantment.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's an underused or misunderstood word. And I think ultimately what we do in the movie game and in any creative game is enchant.
Yeah.
And you got to keep that alive in your children.
Yeah.
100%.
I mean, you can, you know, my daughter's 10 and you know, we're in range probably on Santa, and it just feels like she loves that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And she loves to think about it and like whatever, the magic of it. And we get to have this wonderful day with our family on Christmas and Santa brought it. And then, you know, there's sometimes kids, and this happened to us growing up, where they just cannot wait to blow it for everybody.
Of course.
Right? And it's like, well, why, you know, just let people believe and yeah.
Well, now you've got to come back. You say, well, you don't believe in inspiration. You don't believe in magic.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, where do you think these things come from? You think
that's
they
right.
just thought it without a sprinkle of magic dust from Santa Claus? Santa Claus then becomes a metaphor. It becomes psychologically old enough for her to grasp.
Right.
That it's not a big man in a Coca-Cola colored red coat. So originally Santa Claus was green.
Yeah.
So Coca-Cola did the advertising and they turned that's where the red and white comes from.
Yep.
It's branded by Coca-Cola. Right? A lot of people don't actually realize it comes from St. Nicholas, Santa Claus. who was creating, making toys for the underprivileged kids in the Northern Territories. And he was dressed in green, fur-lined green. And Coca-Cola branded it. Thank you very much. Norman Rockwell immortalized it.
Wow.
You know, and so, but the idea of, and that's what we've lost. And when you know, stop looking at these gifts and stuff as marketplace and, oh, what did you got? Oh, you got the X5. I only got the X4. You could, like, it's gone like that. I mean, we all know the commercialization. But if you can, if they can grasp the concept of that, of actually magic and power, it's actually universal energies that drive things.
Yeah.
And can be drive for good. Right. So don't dismiss the heart of Christmas as the inspiration. What inspired you to get that for Papa?
Right.
Or that, or do that drawing for Mama? Right. There's magic in the air that you were open to and it flowed through you, like musicians grabbing a song.
Right.
They always, the great musicians, songwriters say, you know, it's up there and it just, if you're, it comes to you, melodies come to you.
It is.
You
don't know where. I used to sit down and say, I'm going to write a song
and
right
you can't
now.
Tell them, no, seriously, no, there's an algorithm for that. They say, yeah, right.
No, it ain't, man.
Tell John Lennon he's an algorithm.
Yeah. You know? You're at the grocery store and you're buying milk and it's midnight and then you're just like, holy shit, that's it. And then you like race to your phone or like sing that melody in there that you've been like.
Exactly. Know. Yeah.
It just comes
like
to
Chris,
you.
Chris Cornell driving home and he Black Hole Sun comes to him and he just starts singing it again and again.
Yep.
He says, well, the only home. Time he got home and actually just sang the melody and or played the melody in the thing. He says, normally I wouldn't. I'd get up the next day and I would be there. But this one, he said, I knew something was telling me, put it in.
Because
there were nuances within it.
Yep.
But he's driving home. And he just, of course.
All the best songs come when you're not paying attention.
He's unbelievable, too. Ugh. Well, so you definitely have to have some dad tips, tricks, or road trips advice for other dads. You're very well traveled.
Yes.
And your children, you're raising your family in Spain, in Ibiza.
Yeah. Yeah, she is. I mean, basically, I am literally more like a global citizen. I'm more of a traveling troubadour. So if I get half a year there, it works. But it's a broken half year.
Right.
In and out. And sometimes they're with me, and sometimes, obviously, they can't be. But also, when I'm not working, we do big trips. And ever since they're born, they were basically a papoose in a passport. So they've got no qualms about getting on planes. And I've seen it at airports, right, where... You know, this child is almost like, is so excited. They're doing a big trip with the parents. And this first thing they do in the airport, the mother or the father goes, stop, calm down. We're going to stop. And they're crushing this kid. And you know the parents have built this kid up for weeks or possibly months. We're going to go on that trip. It's all coming up. And here comes the day. And they straight away go, shush, don't embarrass me. You're at an airport. This kid is, I'm on excited. You know, you're crushing me. And you're going to, you know, how can you get this so wrong? This little beautiful mind has been so built up and excited about this trip, and they're expressing their excitement. And your only response is to try and crush it, because you're going to be embarrassed by is by this burst of love and life. Sure. But you built it up. So, I mean, our kids get it. Now they turn and say, Papa, you know, when are we going to go back to Colombia or back to Machu Picchu? When are we going to go to, can we go to Morocco this weekend? Or, you know, I mean, or they'll go themselves, right? The 14-year-old is now flying solo to Paris. He did his work experience there. So he says, I'm old enough to get on the plane on my own. So, yeah, you are. Where you go?
Wow. I can't even imagine that.
Yeah, but they speak four languages. But they can ignore
That's
me
awesome.
In four languages.
That's good.
And they do. And they do.
We're just doing English right now. Yeah,
but it's not, you know, it's, there is, you know, so old adage, there is no rule book. There isn't. There is no rule book. You are the book.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And stuff comes through and you think, oh my God, that was my dad speaking. Yeah, you filtered out all the crap. There was some good stuff there that comes through. Yeah. But you also, the male energy, especially in a male household, and we have such a strong feminine energy in the house and throughout all better sort of circles and all this sort of stuff. But the male energy is very real and they need to have their boundaries, but the boundaries have to be set and fluid. And it's like sometimes when I'm going to get in trouble for this, but sometimes when it, obviously, I don't want to go to school, not while you're at school, I'm not going to. So I'll throw some cold water in your face to wake you up because you stayed up too late. Like, no. So I do. I go and get a glass of cold water. Splash. The shock. Papa, you did it. I told you I was going to do it. Now get up. Get up and get dressed. And then if it happens again, I said, shall I get a glass of water?
Well, now they know it's
no,
coming.
Papa. Yeah. No, and I only did it once on two of them.
That is awesome.
Yeah, because they went on and I reasoned and I talked and I says, I woke up in a great mood. I refuse to get angry, right? And you're a little bit sleepy. I can just tell. You're all grumpy bollocks. Right? It's time for a glass of water. Splash! And it's like, Mama, guess what? Oh, stop complaining, son.
I think that's the one thing I'm missing in the mornings because I just got Laney's just going to get some water in the face tomorrow, I think.
Well, this is our Something's Brewing section. We're going to, Ray, we have some beautiful, cold, super ice cold beer from Minnesota. Yeah. It's from Ham's Brewery, one of our favorites.
Land of Sky Blue Waters.
I hope this isn't a comment on my acting.
No, it's definitely not.
Being a ham. No. Thank you very much.
Yes, cheers.
Slancha. Cheers.
Slancha.
Cheers.
This is my favorite.
Yes, this is our go-to.
Oh.
Nice and refreshing.
That is refreshing.
This segment of Something's Brewing is sponsored by Ham's Brewery, our favorite beer. Looking for that sponsorship, and hopefully we can get that. See, this is what I love. You are just so worldly that your stories are just so, like, I'm mesmerized here. I'm like, you know, I have like Chris and I have an itinerary. We're sitting there like our
you're
mouths are
an Irish, yeah. If you've got to shut me up, I'll just keep on talking. Yeah.
this is awesome.
One of the, not to cut you out. I mean, I just, you know, my wife and I talk a lot now, you know, about just the kids and they're getting a little bit older and you know, one of the best trips we had, was a road trip we took. You know, two summers ago, none of us could fly anywhere and all that. And we just kind of got in a car and we had some cities picked and like, you know, whatever the kids thought was cool, that's what we were doing. And I remember like we stopped in Bozeman and Vetter thought that this chair, it was like a couch where you can pull it and it also has a footrest. Oh. Was the coolest thing he had ever seen. Like he still talks about the house in Bozeman that we rented basically to do laundry. And I'm like, dude, it's the fucking Tetons over there. But like, whatever, right?
Like the chair on Friends.
And just, you know, when I was growing up, I was born in England and my whole family was over there. And my mom, we didn't have much money. But like when we did have money, we went to England. And
right.
I don't think I took that for granted. But like it's, you know, everybody else is going to Florida. No offense, but like I was going to England and going to see London, right? And the places I grew up and all that stuff. And Amy talks a lot about like, just get it. Where can we go to get the kids those just experiences right now? And you know, going to Colombia and like your son's going to Paris and you guys live in Spain, like that's just insane. And I think a lot of times in America, I feel like, again, because my family's from England, like everybody focuses on like, what do you have? How big's your TV?
I know. And the thing about the States is, don't forget, is that you'd think nothing about driving 2-3 hours.
Right.
Right. Well, hour and a half, we can be from Ibiza, we can be in Rome.
Right.
That's crazy.
See, that's 2.5 hours we're in London. 2 hours or 2.5 hours we're in Paris. So, you know, 3 hours we're in Marrakesh. And it's just not having that block of going like it's a huge distance where you'd feel nothing about a 3 hour drive to Vegas. Is it a 3 hour drive?
Yeah, it's about that.
It's about a 3 hour drive, right? So, but in 3 hours you could be from a visit to Marrakesh. Right.
3 hours there, the way home is just a nightmare.
Way
it's
home
like
is
six
14
hours.
Hours, I think. Yeah.
Sometimes the traffic is miserable.
Yeah. I mean, even just, you know, this weekend I started Friday morning playing pickle with some friends of the pod, Jeff Welch, Stan Major, and Sheen Dwyer. At the club, ran along the ocean, and then got in the car for 2 hours. But then we were up at 8,000 feet in the mountains, right? And that's just California, and it's just there's so much for us to do. You get caught in like the rat race and different things, but like the kids aren't going to remember the rat race. They're going to remember the
experience,
the time they hiked at Zion last summer, or you know.
No, I've heard actors out here go like, you know, that they won't leave LA in case they miss a meeting. I said, well, what the hell are you bringing to your work?
Right.
What's your life experience? Right. The 405. Whoop-de-doo. I said, what are you doing next? Well, I'm playing an 18th century scientist who works out a bit. Or I'm playing a 20th century
I was up for that role.
Who works out a bit. And you go like, mate.
That's so funny.
And he's like, you know, I'm not getting interesting characters. I said, it's because you're not interesting. You haven't lived. And I was one job. I think it was the Punisher. So we were filming Montreal in wintertime. And everybody was getting beaten up like crazy. And the producers, very generously, said, we got this amazing spa, this amazing person, they're going to do beautiful facials and because everything's been dried out and tight.
Right.
And I was just like, whatever, thanks very much. And I go there and they've got this big light mirror, this big light sort of magnifying that, and she's peering in and going, oh, I see you got some sunspots here, I got some cream for this, you got some lines and that, a bit of dry skin, and we're going to take all this out. I said, stop, stop right now. These sunspots came from climbing up in, near Mont Blanc, and I was closer to the sun. These wrinkles came from laughing so much. The dry skin from a yacht I was on. I said, don't you dare touch. This is a map of my life.
Wow.
Right? And I said, what do you think makes it interesting to look at an actor? It's what's behind their eyes, no matter what character they're playing, and their face. You also inhabits that. So you, these characters have lives, have lived through wars, or lived through, I mean, you know. Otherwise, you just got this plastic, fantastic look, and you're always thinking about it was how I look. Where's the character? I'm just driven more to serve that.
Yeah. Right? Isn't traveling fueling your soul?
It makes you. It does. It makes you so much. It makes you more interested in places and more interesting. Through, by proxy, you know, it's not like you consider yourself, I'm a really interesting person now. No, you say, I can't wait. This, you realize how much more interesting stuff is out there and how, you know, it's accessible to you by just the flick of it's the flick of the switch going, but I can just do this. I can just go there. I can go to, I mean, also Ojai. If you mean Ojai in the stream, where they put some rock pool, they created different temperature rock pools.
You park
on the road and you go down this little track and where the river's bubbling, the water's cold, but they've rocked off, whoever the hippie or whatever, they've rocked off these three areas and one's super hot, one's medium temperature, and you just go down, you're down there in the trees, in nature. It's just there.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Where's your favorite place that you're taking the kids?
Oh, my word.
One place.
Wow. Well, they're all different ages. I mean, you know, Patagonia was amazing. We went on this.
What's in Chile?
Or
Argentina.
It's southern Chile. I just say Puerto Montt down southern Chile. And I remember somebody saying, oh my God, look, this is the end of the world. And I went, no, this is the beginning. Go north and see what we did with it. This is how it should be. Right. But it's, you've got the fjords and all that. And this ship we're on, because we always do a massive Christmas holiday time. Holiday with the family, and so it's like 17 Italians and me, and they range from the grandparents to one-year-old babies. We're just not shy about that, and we just pack them all up and just go two, three, four.
Ray's wife is from Italy.
Yeah, and nice. And so we're down there on this explorer boat called the Atmosphere, I think it was. They got two helicopters. They do extreme fishing. They helicopter you right up into the mountains, the trout and salmon mountains, and with a guide, and you go fly fishing all day long, and the helicopter you back down, or you do eco walk, go up and see blue hanging glaciers. And I had a rucksack, and we only had the first boy Sebastian. I had a rucksack with a seat on it, so I'm hiking up a volcano, and he's there banging on my head, going pa 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 pa. I've got a photograph of his first helicopter ride with the massive
earmuffs so awesome.
On, and he's looking at me like that, and looking at, and he's just a baby, but you know, there's something in him that he took from that trip, even if it's not about the physical, and I prove you were there. What's the physical memories? What's this? No, there's something much more deeper. Don't ever think that kids don't get it. They get it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just, and also you get that closer experience with them. You don't say, you know, oh, this be no good. I'm going to carry a baby around. What do you mean carry a baby? It's your child. It's not a piece of luggage.
Right.
so it's just, I mean, you know, you got kids, basically, you know, this is you. And it's like, you know, your kids don't belong to you. That you belong to them. Just don't tell them that. But it's the truth. You belong to them. They've arrived as new souls on here, and you just happen to be attached as their sort of physical parents, right? So you belong to them.
That's beautiful.
That's profound. I love
that's
that.
That's unbelievable.
It changes, just these little shifts in perspective changes your attitude to everything. As I remember one dad coming, one guy many years ago, and his son was like 13 or 14 or so, and his dad had it, and he looked at me, and he's... All the time, he's going, Dad, 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 can you look at this? Can you look at this? I says, oh, well, look on the bright side. One day he'll stop.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Right? There's a reality check. One day he won't ask you.
Right. Oh. I mean,
it's like that song, Cats in the Cradle.
I mean,
that tears your heart apart, but my God, it only tears your heart apart because there's some home bloody truths in it.
Yeah, of course there is.
Right?
I mean, tomorrow night, Bill Kotzman, friend of the pod, invited us to the Dodgers game, and so... My son is seven. He's playing. He's adorable, and he's never been to a baseball game. And you know, my first thing was think about. I was like, all right, what time do we have to leave? There's going to be traffic and all this stuff. But like, I remember my first baseball game. We might have sat in traffic for 10 hours. I have no fucking idea.
No.
All I remember is walking into that stadium.
Oh. Yeah,
and That's all. It's not about me.
No, I took my son to a rugby match. We saw the All Blacks in Paris.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
Wow. Oh, yeah. And he's going, yeah, I can still get the photographs. I was just like, we flew up there, stayed one night, and then flew back. And it's the first time he went in, saw the Haka. He's in this massive crowd. It's embedded in him.
Yeah. Of course.
You know? And because it's real. It's not through the medium of a screen or anything. You're
in it.
Yeah, and then I did a Comic-Con in Prague, I think. Was it Prague?
Love Prague.
I did a Comic-Con in Prague. And I brought... the elder boy was I think it could have been away in Paris. So, and I said, well, I'll take the two little ones. And Paris going, what? Are you sure? You got a Comic-Con event? I said, no, they've got somebody laid on to actually take them around the stands and all this while I'm doing my signings and stuff like this. And they were so made up. And they got suit jackets because there was an event later on. I said, yeah, of course you're with me, sons. And then we shared this nice suite. And they were going, oh, we're in the suite. Yeah. And you just, all these little things. But it was our time.
Yeah.
It was actually about time. And they said, right, we have to be ready by 7. And then the big thing was, I told them before, we have to get the first flight out in the morning, right? Which means that you guys are up at 4:30 in the morning, 4:45. See, yes, Papa. See, Papa. Sir. And but they said this, and sure enough, come that 4:30, these bleary-eyed little ones who are normally the nightmare, they were up. So, yeah, oh, right, okay, we're good, because they packed a little bit the night before. And then they were so proud to tell their mama. And 4:30, we were
That's
up,
great.
Mama. Papa, we were up and ready for the flight back. And you just go like, just talk to them like normally and just say, this is this. It's not like a rule. It's like saying, this is what we need to do.
Yeah.
And they go, right, okay. If you don't tell them, they keep getting shocked. And you realize, oh, we're doing this now. And they've just settled down to something. No, why? So, no. Hey, well, I'm your parent. We're doing this now. Oh, now you stop this and we're doing this. And they're out of sync. So you obviously don't involve them in all things, but there's certain things you involve them in. So if it's in their head, they go like, okay, so I'm 6 o'clock. And you go, look at the clock. But no, it's not been in hours. Says, look at that. Right? And they say, okay, yeah, it's 6 o'clock. He did say 6 o'clock. You know, just these simple little triggers. Because don't treat them like stupid. But even if they complain, you say, oh, we all agreed.
They're just not treating them as this thing that I've got to take care of and do.
As property.
Like, you're going to make this experience better. Like, I can kind of go do whatever, but the fact that I'm bringing
Jordan Peterson said something really interesting. He said, don't allow your kids to do anything that will make you like them less. You're always going to love them, but if they start doing stuff that's going to make you not like them, stop them from doing it.
Right.
Because they haven't got that reasoning capacity. It's just like, whoa, right? You know, it's just like, yeah. And don't allow yourself to start to like, I really don't like that about him. You know, I guess it's like when parents, I've had this thing before when they look, especially young children, and they start getting very possessive with their toys. Share, you want to share? They go, no, it's my toy. You know, and they straight away go like, you know, like last year, they would share everything. I don't know what's happened. And of course, the kid's hearing this, feeling that all of a sudden they become this demonic creature that doesn't share anymore. And I turn around and I says, a year ago, they had no concept of ownership. And yet you think they're sharing? They had no concept of ownership. Only when they have a perception of ownership, right? Of course they're going, this is mine. This is them learning about ownership. And then they can experience and understand what sharing is.
Right.
You think they were sharing last year. They didn't own anything. They're just things around them. So what are you doing to your kids? It's actually just like, whoa, just pause a minute. Ask the right question here. Are they being selfish? Or do you, through your wish fulfillment, think they were, you know, sainted little sharing, altruistic kids? They didn't have a sense of ownership. And when you get that, you go, oh, yeah, right, okay. You know, it's, and I didn't know this going in. It's something, you know, you start to realize, why? And you start to think about it. Well, think about it. Take some time and do the work.
You know, this whole interview is like a constant dad question. And so... even though we're going to hit the dad wisdom section now, you're hitting so many questions, or you're answering many questions that I have already scripted. You know, this is great. Like,
you did Tommy's job for him.
This is amazing. This is like, well, you bring an Irishman to the table, you're gonna have a party. Yeah, you're gonna have a party.
Irishman drinking hams.
What does being a dad mean to you, Ray?
Everything. I was married once before. And we were together 9 years and no children. And there was always a place we couldn't get to. And a lovely woman. I married a woman I fell in love with and meant the vows I took. And we had counseling for the last 2-3 years, kept trying everything, trying. And so you have to just realize there was just a place we couldn't get to. And I'm not going to, you know, bring a child. I've seen that before. People bring a child into a relationship to think they're going to fix it. And then you start blaming the child when the relationship is still not fixed. I mean, you know, there's lots of fundamental mistakes have been made. And bear in mind, it's a lot easier to build a child than repair an adult.
Right.
So if you're going to create a broken adult by not building this child properly. So it is a responsibility. But I love the idea. I just felt it inside about being a father. So it crushed me. I was 40 years old when we got divorced. And I was feeling so destroyed and sorry for myself. And I, you know, when am I going to find the right girl, court the right girl, marry the right girl, and be a dad? And I was just desperate. And put myself in quite a real depression about it. And I remember 4 o'clock, half a bottle of whiskey in my hand. I think the other bottle was empty. Looking in the mirror, tears streaming down my face. And it was just, and it's just this, like, who the hell do you think you are? Voice came in, boom. Look at you. Where is it carved into stone, Mr. Bloody Wonderful, that you, right, are blessed enough to have be a natural father, right? How dare you think, if you want to be involved, if there's, you've got a path to be involved in children, maybe your role is going to be helping groups of children, right, as a father figure or whatever in the future. Or maybe the child who's going to be orphaned hasn't even been born yet, that you're going to be perhaps blessed with being a foster or an adoption father. I said, you know, who the hell do you think you are? And this weight went off me.
Yeah.
Who the hell do I think I am? And so, you know, getting over that. So what did it mean to me? It's meant everything. I tell you, after the birth of the first child, the biggest revelation was, what the hell did I do before I had children?
Isn't it crazy?
Wow.
It's like, yeah. It's like all that stuff, all that worrying, career. Blah, blah, blah. I look at it, I can't even find a conscious place to think. And it's like, oh yeah, that was for this, that was for this. No. Children come along, and you go like, oh my word. I was half alive.
I mean, I always tell people, a buddy of mine at work with you just had his first kid, and I always say, like, the best 10 million moments of your life haven't even happened yet.
Exactly.
Right? Like, just none of that matter. You had good times, you meet good people.
Yeah.
You know, the most dear friends I have in my life, Tommy here. Yeah. It's like,
I find it's a blur before I was married and
kind of blurs.
I mean, like, it probably was literally for me, but I mean,
yeah. HD comes on.
I mean, it's like, I don't remember anything before I met my wife. It's like I foggy mind from 2000 to 2008 until I met my wife. And then I can remember every year now from 2008 on, crystal clear.
They calibrated for you.
Yes.
I remember one of the most impressionable stories that I was gifted with. I was lying in bed with my eldest son. He was about 6 or 7. And he was saying, because I always got a pad and notepad and something. He said, why do you, because he was going on about, I didn't want to do his homework. Why do I have to do homework? I said, well, why do you not want to learn? He said, well, what do you mean? I said, why do you think I carry a pad and a pen? I said, I just jot it down. I don't want to forget it. Make a little note, make a little scribble. I don't know if I'm going to come back to it. And I says, but, you know, homework is something that you, one day you have to set your own homework. It's not set by school. This is just about getting you into the window. Like, if you don't do your homework, you won't be able to do the thing that you love doing. So you do your homework on it, and it never stops. And then you realize the whole world and life is basically homework, and you're the home. And you can learn from anything and everything, no matter where you are. And I write something down. Maybe I've learned something. And he lay there in bed. He says, "Oh, okay. Papa." I went, "Yeah." He says, "What have you learned from me?"
Ooh.
Wow.
Ooh.
Wow.
Wow.
And I was just about to make some stock answer, and I stopped. I says, "Hang on." I said, "Son," I said, "that's a beautiful question." I said, "Let me think about that." And I count my blessings. Something came through me, and I said, "You know what I learned from you, son? You taught me how to be a dad, because before you, I wasn't one."
Oh.
He threw his arm around me, kissed me, and says, "Love you, Papa." 2 weeks later, we're sitting at breakfast. I said, "Do you want to tell Mama about this? You know, you said, what have you learned from me?" And, you know, you said, I learned to be a dad and done it. He said, "Can't remember." So there's always a great love.
Yeah.
But at that moment,
right,
he made, it was when I'd never thought about it until that question was asked, and look for the honest answer. Yeah. You know what I learned from you? I didn't know how the hell to be a dad.
Right.
I'm still learning every day.
Yeah.
And you hit it. Because all the books that tell you what to expect when expecting, you know, all that stuff, you can read some of it and, you know, okay, there's nothing better.
Then the next one comes along and you think, I've got this. Right. I've got this. And you think, who are you? This doesn't work on you because you're, you're a brand new person. Yeah. And also you realize that you have the capacity because you think, the big worry, am I going to be, do I have enough love? I got so much, all my love's taken by number one. Am I just going to, boom, your heart just goes, And it's like, and then number three, I'm just like, wham, it goes that, and so, you know, you're learning a whole new being a dad and being a dad and being a dad. And then you're being a dad to three as well as one, as well as two at a time, as well as three at a time.
Yeah.
With all, and so, you know, it's not dull.
No, never a dull day, especially in the Stevenson house. If you have one piece of a parenting advice, what would it be to other dads?
Take care of the mother.
I love that.
Great one.
Protect the mother. Defend her. Take care of her because they'll rip the piss out of her. My boys do. I can hear it in a tone of voice. And from across the room, all I'd have to do is, whoa. How did you speak to mama? Sorry, papa. Because she'll breeze it and let them get away with it. She's a mama. And they're going, no. I said, your mother might, you might think your mother's putting up with it. I'm not putting up with it.
That's great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, also with boys, they want to have they're very thrusting, physical sort of boys. And there was one time when, one of them, we don't do physical violence, but boys are what they are.
They're boys.
Turned around and took a swing at better. So I took him to his room. I says, here's the thing, son. I says, you know, mama, that's your mama. You raise your hand to your mama. That's my partner. Never forget that. She may be your mama. But you take a swing at her and I'll come for you, because that's my partner. Right? That means you disrespected not only her, you disrespected the relationship, you disrespected me. You raise your hand to any woman. And, you know, it's just one of those. I can't remember how old the one I was talking to then, because you tailor to the age group.
Sure.
Right? And to the person. I think that's one of the most important things. See your kids as people, as, you know, they're fresh and new and their instincts are kind of weirdly developed, and they can be skewed and skewered, but their vocabulary and their sophistication needs to grow, mm-hmm. and their experiences need to grow and learn from. But the person they are is inside them.
Yeah,
you know, and it's just, you know, they know what's right and what's wrong, because as soon as you things got away. Hey, it happens to all of us. Just also be real about it. You know,
well,
what's your most embarrassing moment as a dad?
I don't know. Embarrassing moments as a dad. What I embarrass them? No, where I embarrass myself. Embarrassing moments as a dad. I don't know.
Stumped you.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure
you haven't been embarrassed.
I think no. I mean, no. It's not about being embarrassed. I think you'd have to ask Elizabeth about that. How embarrassed she was by me.
Yeah. I was going to say, I'm always. It's probably a better question for my kids and my wife.
Well, give me an example, Tommy.
There's this one dad that it was a celebrity dad, and he was going through LAX with his child, and the child had to go to the bathroom really bad. He had to take a poo, and the kid was about 18 months old, and when he walked in to change the diaper, another explosion happened, and he had shit all over his shirt and chest, and he basically had to go out of you got to leave the bathroom eventually, and he changed this child, and then he goes through and immediately goes to one of those stores inside the airport to get another shirt. But he's like, that was when I walked out, everyone knew that was shit on me. But so something like that.
Yeah.
But
I'll wear it with pride.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Role models.
Oofa, my dad.
Definitely. Love this. Why?
My dad, definitely. Because he was a gentleman and he was honest, an honest man. And I saw him, he was not a very successful, say, in what terms people
in wealth terms,
yeah,
but successful but, to the
no,
nth
but
degree.
What I saw, what I witnessed was this man grow and achieve a grace as soon as he let that feeling of being a failure go, which he felt from other people. We were the poor side of the family, right? Nobody bothered. And all of a sudden, I started doing movies. The amount of calls from cousins I get, it's amazing. Fucking cousins everywhere. But this man grew until he let go of that nonsense. And this man found a peace, and he grew in grace. And it's like, unfortunately, he was taken early, too early. And he died before the boys were born. I knew that if the boys were alive, their feet would never have touched the ground. Right. And I still find myself at times, the lump comes, I well up and I cry like a baby. Yeah. And you know what? And it hurts.
Yeah.
And I would not exchange one essence of that pain to have loved them less. Because I know at the end of that, when I come through that little grief moment, that whatever that grief moment is, at the end I've got a big smile on my face and say, yeah, I still know how much that love carves inside me. So yeah, I want the pain. That, because it's an honest, true heart pain of the life that he imbued forward. And his morals and his
loyalty,
moral courage, his moral fiber. He was a decent man. I saw him glow later on. He achieved his state of grace and allowing his humor to come through, despite what knocks the world had given him and all this sort of stuff. There was the core of a real decent human being in there.
It's beautiful.
Nice.
It's so beautiful. Death. That's something that Americans are, and frankly,
I was going to say, pardon? Not death. Death.
Yeah.
What about it? What do you want to know?
How do you explain?
I'll tell you anything.
Has anybody passed of like the family?
Well,
with the kids alive now.
What she definitely explores is she's got a doctorate in contemporary anthropology. She's got one of those most amazing, beautiful, inquiring minds about humans and about humanism about different sort of tribes and cultures and contemporary cultures and how every culture deals with it, right? And some cultures celebrate it. They put a party on. Other ones want to put it away to the side and just pretend it never really happened. And, oh, you're grieving. It's always about the grievers, how grief-stricken they can be and stuff like that. But it's a very real thing. It's like you lose a limb or you lose something, and you can lose yourself in grief. Death, how we consider it is that we do believe that, you know, I mean, here's a point was that we do believe that there's an energy that travels throughout, and this is the vehicle we're in, shall we say, that sense. But also there's another sense that it's like, you know, it's not something to be, it's like when you die, do you carry on, or does the energy disperse and reform into however that energy is going to come back? You know what I mean? So it's not about walking around and what have you, but it's like, I say to people, here's an example, right? You look at a brand new baby, and you look at your grandparent. Who's got the biggest soul?
Oh, that's a great question.
Neither. Soul doesn't have a size.
Huh.
Right? That soul is energy that carries you and comes through your life. And whatever life throws at you in this physical manifestation, your soul isn't smaller when you're a baby, and it isn't bigger when you're a grandparent or an octogenarian. You haven't said, my soul's massive and your soul's only this big. No, you say, like, you know, you're only young. You haven't had experiences, right?
Exactly.
That's a different sort of thing. But the soul, that's energy. So what about death? Do you think the soul died? It's an energy that comes and passes through a vehicle form. So it's like and on this note, actually, it's a very serious point. My 10-year-old and 11-year-old now, he suffers what people would say would be night terrors. Night terrors, right?
I had that.
And it's a very important thing. But if you've got to try, when you calm somebody down.
Does that mean like he has having the realization that he's going to die someday?
He's terrified of being alive.
Wow.
Because he has to die. Ugh. And he doesn't want to be alive because he has to die. I know there's the paradox.
No.
And, you know, but it's very real to him. You can't just like get yourself to bed. Don't be so bloody stupid. Grow up. You know, very real.
Yeah.
And I'm obviously very concerned, very aware of the young teenager he's going to become, how he deals with this. And what it is this, he's got one of the most incredible, firing imaginations. So that also has a dark side to it. His imaginations of the dark side are very real, as much as his glorious imaginations on the light side. So you can't dismiss one without the other. And we've developed our own communication through it.
Right? I've had that problem.
Yeah.
I remember,
very real.
I remember running
into
my parents.
And I don't want him to be that teenager.
Yeah.
That has that moment where there's no one there because they've never been there and they've never.
He's 11.
Forced. Yeah.
Yeah. That's probably so.
We
that's
talk about it on, now. Long distance is difficult, obviously now, but yeah. We're able to get on the phone with me privately or on the thing. Can I talk to Papa alone? Yeah. And I know what's coming, and it'll be. And I'll say, did you? I had the feeling again, Papa, and then we'll talk through it.
Yeah.
But we know it's getting less and less.
Yeah.
You know, but. Making him aware that he's not alone, and it's very personal, and that is
that's huge.
Not allowing his brothers or anything, you guys, kids do and stuff like this, because he keeps it very much to himself and da da da. But then, because he's got a heart the size of a planet and he wears it on his sleeve, but you can't just you can't dismiss these things. They're,
of course,
they're real to them. That's why Santa Claus is very real to me.
Yeah,
you know. So if it's real to me, he bloody well exists. It's magic. So you know, that's and so you approach death and you go like, you know, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it.
I mean, my father died when I was 6.
Right.
And I was very acutely aware of the end game.
Yeah.
And having those conversations with my mom too, where you just like, you can't.
No.
Like you could drive yourself crazy.
Yeah.
Just knowing that that's what's going to happen.
And it can rob you of an aspect of your childhood.
Right.
So you got to find a place, a safe place. That you can coexist with it and still have a childhood.
Right. And we always had, you know, my uncle in England and my cousins and my mom and all these people who remembered my father and would tell me stories of those things, right? And, and he's always been alive.
Yeah.
He's always been there. He's been with us, you know. And my stepdad's coming out on Thursday. He's been here 7 years. My mom got remarried and she passed 3 years ago. And we say to my stepdad now, like, Dad, the kids need to learn about grandma through you.
Yeah.
Right. You are here and you're.
That's it.
It's Grandparents Day Friday. You still get to go, right? Yeah. And
so it's like they got to step up.
And you're going to go to all these games and stuff, but like you've got to tell her stories and that's the only thing you can do because we're all going to be gone one day,
mate. Yeah, and it's also like when there's minor infractions or things, you know, don't blow them, don't overblow them up into something because in 50 years, who's going to give a damn? And as they say, don't damage people.
Yep.
It's a bigger world than that.
Yep.
And it's been very concerning. We're talking about this craziness over the last 2 years and what have you. From whatever perspective you want, and I'm not here to cause a judgment or to denote judgment, but I loathe the fact, and I'm saddened by the fact of how much has been dismissed and not told about a huge spike in teenage suicides.
Yeah, yeah.
Also now, people who are getting in their 40s and 50s, people are suiciding because they're getting hopeless. And they're getting their concept of their future. At the time, they're on the cusp of it, completely stripped from them by a narrative that is already so full of holes. And and we have a responsibility to say, yeah, you haven't got a future in the old matrix, in the old way, because did you not realize you were on a hamster wheel,
right
to go to school. Your school system was set up as factory hours to turn out little factory workers or little
then
office workers and da da da, and then you're done. As is, but now we have an opportunity to say now we have an opportunity to learn to be human beings. We're the only things on the planet that we call beings. We don't say tiger being or eagle being or shark being. We're a human being.
Yeah,
and I think the reason is that you know, so many people have been going through school, high school, higher education, universities, degrees for jobs that don't bloody exist,
right,
and won't exist, and they're massively in debt, and debt is money that also debt doesn't exist. What do you mean debt? I'll pay the principal back. Thank you very much. Who do I owe? You know, the world is in debt to itself for 10 times the value of all the world's assets. That money doesn't exist.
I know that.
So it's like, who the hell do I owe debt to? How can I owe something that does not exist? Anyway, that's a different argument for a different day. But you kind of impress on them. You're like, is that the work you want to do? And it's this concept of work. What actually is work? Work has always been tailored to a means to get money, to provide for this and have your Jeep and have your this and da da da. You go like, is that it?
Right.
That's all money is.
I know.
to go full circle.
Sorry. See, got me off on tangents.
My dad would say to me during those times, and you said it to your son, he would have me talk about living.
Yeah.
What did you do today?
Yeah.
Isn't that great?
What
he would take me out of.
What did you find that was new?
So he would he'd always say, just keep living. You know, tomorrow you're going to do the same thing. I guarantee you're going to come back and tell me three great things that you did today.
That's great.
Yeah. So he would focus on the life that I was bringing. It was probably like a dark 6 months. I was like probably the same age, around 10, 11 years old. And I'm like, I don't want to die.
See, there's a wisdom.
But like he brought this oracle figure that he would let. I'd go screaming, running into his room.
Yeah.
And he'd be like, and like, calm me down. I'd lay in his bed. And he's like, just tell me what you did today.
That's great.
And he'd tell me like, that's living. That's great.
Yeah.
And then it would just slowly.
Exactly. He wasn't talking down to you.
Like, that was,
he wasn't dismissing you or talking down to you.
He didn't say, get back in your room.
Or using top psychological therapy.
Right, no.
He was just saying, tell me what you did.
That's it.
It's amazing.
So simple, right?
Remind yourself you're alive. Yeah. That's it. Keep it simple.
I mean, we've got, like, the kids will be, bedtime's coming up, right? And I can't wait to just, like, literally just say that. Like, the kids put them in. What did you learn today? You know, it was Monday. You woke up this morning. They're always ornery on Monday.
I started with one of them. I started I got just a notebook, blank notebook, and I said, "What's this for, Pa?" I said, "It's a what if book." He says, "What?" I said, "Right on the front, what if?" I said, anytime you have an idea, no matter how crazy it is, like what if you had metal sheeting that you turn electricity and it goes soft, and you create a skeleton inside that could form the shape of a boat, and you turn it off and it hardens. Then you say, "I want a car now." So you got to let the skeleton moves underneath and the skin harden. What if that material existed? What if you had this show called Star Trek? You wanted people to communicate to each other over vast distances with a little handheld thing. What if that
was possible?
Wouldn't
that be crazy?
Wouldn't that be incredible?
Yeah.
What if, you know? And it says, you know, Pablo Picasso put it very well as well. And also, I bring these references in because I also humanize history for them. I humanize these people. They're not cold, sterile things in books. These are living, breathing, vital people. Like Pablo Picasso said, if man can imagine it, it exists. Technology has to catch up, but if you can imagine it, it exists. So be careful, right? And also, positive thoughts and negative thoughts. But you can imagine it. So what if?
Yeah.
What if?
I'm going to do it tonight.
How do you want to be remembered as a dad? If your three boys, once you're passed, they could speak, how are they going to talk about you?
I don't know. One thing I said to my mother, because she developed a bit of dementia and Alzheimer's towards the end, and I got in there just before. I didn't realize it was going to be really bad. And I remember I just took the opportunity and I just said, oh, Mom, I've got something to tell you. She said, what? Just thank you for my life.
Wow.
And she filled up. She's an Irish woman. But, and later when she passed away, she's got keeping her safe and not scared and all this sort of stuff. You give gratitude. And to not focus on, I like my kids to find that gratitude and grace. I think they have it as well. But not to focus on gratitude to me, but gratitude for that openness that came through me that I hopefully have imbued in them. So that's the continuation of they are paying respects and thanking me by allowing themselves to continue and grow and be open. It's not about, don't fix me as a fixed thing, right? Because you're not a fixed thing. Don't ever fix yourself as a fixed thing. And giving them that spirit, you know, they'll continue. And I think they'll thank me in their actions and their experiences and in their tears and in their joys. It'd be, you know, that it doesn't need to be laid at my door, but it's love, basically.
Love that.
Well, folks, we could go on for a year with this guy.
We're going to have to do part two.
I mean, seriously, there's just, we only hit
half
these.
I have a girl. She's desperate. She would love a girl. Maybe we might adopt because, you know, we're getting to a certain age now. But if we adopt a girl, I'm open to it. Right? And then I think, or better off. it'd be, whose daughter? You want to take my daughter? Yeah? Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Nope. Go away. But a friend of mine, an actor friend of mine, he's got twin daughters who are young girls who are gorgeous, just like their mother. And he says, This young kid came up. He's about 11, 12. Hi, so-and-so. And he's going like, go away. Save yourself. They're turning into their mother. You won't. He said, I'm defending the guys coming to take my daughter because they're turning into them. They're going like, they have me so wrapped around their fingers. I'm going like, how did that happen?
Of course.
What? Uh-huh. Yeah. He's protecting the boys coming.
Of course.
Nah, but it's just, you know, I don't have girls. You've got one of each. I don't know what.
Yeah.
Yep. Same.
Right. So, but I see a lot of struggles with friends of ours who have their teenage girls, just the whole TikTok thing and da 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 da. And I don't have or presume to know any of the answers unless I'm there on the spot. And I just deal with it. I don't know. I never presume how you're going to deal with it. Never go in with a game plan. The game plan is honesty.
I'll give you my dad's advice on that. Please. One. It was, I raised my sons tough and my girls tougher.
Love that.
That's how he did that one.
Nice.
God bless you, Dad.
Nice. God bless him.
Listen, this is an honor. I could talk for another 5 hours. Want to thank our friends of the pod for listening.
I love the intelligence of this show.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
It's not wasted, silly, asinine questions, you know?
No, it's not.
I say bless you guys for doing this, and I feel privileged and honored to be part of it. So thank you guys very much.
Both ways. Thank you for that.
This is great. And again, if we could just help any dad find any light in anything that we talk about.
Or just resonate with somebody who goes, oh, God, right, I'm not alone. And,
right.
And yeah, I can trust myself.
Yeah.
I just be honest with myself.
Hey, I'm very happy. I actually went back and asked my wife, how would you like your Mother's Day to go?
Nice.
Thanks to Dr. Sarah Kersey from last week.
Friend
so,
of the pod.
Like, we're actually getting better as dads, too, by doing this. Talking to you today, I'm a better dad.
Bah.
This is great. You know? Listen, everyone out there, thank you for listening to Dad's Night Podcast, where ridiculous becomes reality. Please like and share this podcast with a friend or two or 100. And when you get a chance, please go rewatch Kill the Irishman. That is one of the greatest movies if you have not seen it or watch it again for a 100th
time. It's a fantastic movie,
and
I'm not just saying that. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's not just because that's my movie I produced. That is the movie that I got to meet this beautiful soul of a man, Ray Stevenson.
With a great nod on my shoulder.
Yeah, there it is. He's still excited.
Tommy,
still
what's our email?
DazNightPodcast@gmail.com.
Do we have an Instagram?
Yes, we do. @DazNightPodcast. Please like and follow us. And again, thank you for taking the time to listen.
Thank you, Ray.
We really appreciate it.
That was amazing. Thank you, everybody.